You are listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode of CEO Perspectives, a new podcast series by the Conference Board. CEO Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, data-driven look at a range of timely topics that matter most to business executives. To help make sense of these topics and how they'll unfold, we'll sit down with thought leaders and do what we do best at the Conference Board, provide insights for what's ahead. I'm Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board and the host of this podcast series, and we're back for part three of our conversation with Dr. Uwe Schulte. Uwe didn't know there was going to be a part three to this series, but we keep adding it to him. Uwe is the leader of our Global Sustainability Center at the Conference Board, and previously in parts one and two, we covered various aspects of sustainability and climate change, and now we're going to take a deeper dive into another topic that we just touched on at the end of part two, and that's the subject of energy. What are the pros and cons of each energy source? What does the future of energy look like? And what is the role of business and government in getting us there? Uwe, welcome back for part three.
Thank you for having me again.
Again, yes. Well, Uwe, you are our expert in every way. You're a scientist, you're a data guy, and you understand energy better than anybody I know. But, you know, let's just try to, you know, do the basics first here. What's the mix of energy production today in the world? What are the sources and how does that look and what are the trends?
First of all, Steve, I would like to clarify something because people sometimes confuse energy consumption and electricity production mix with overall energy. And let's talk about overall energy. And that means it's energy that we need for transport, it's for industrial production, it's for domestic heating and cooling, and so on and so forth. It's not just electricity. And if we take all of that, according to the International Energy Agency in 2019, 26% of that energy was produced through coal, 23% through gas, and the majority was produced in 31% by oil, 5% nuclear, and 14% renewables. So that gives you an overview, and it's very mixed across the nations, across the regions, and in the different applications. But I think an interesting number is that India and China account for almost 80% of the coal consumption. Europe is 8%, and the US is only 9%. And the rest of the world is then 3%, of course.
That's interesting. So you're saying 26% coal, 23% gas, 31%. So that's 80% fossil fuel production of energy, and only less than 20% with nuclear and renewables. But coal is the dirtiest and it's the cheapest, which is probably why you see India and China, which are big countries and developing nations, you know, sort of stuck in that, in the consumption of coal.
You see, this is interesting. Actually, it isn't the cheapest anymore.
Yeah.
But of course, there are different aspects. And what I like to use is levelized cost of energy. And what does that mean? Is you look at the whole life cycle of an energy production facility, and you look at the total cost, and then you convert it back to the amount of energy that can be produced through a facility like that. So efficiency, productivity, and all of that comes into that as well. And of course, upfront investment and running costs. When you look at that, suddenly things look very, very different. So 10 years back, you know, we were still struggling and had a lot of subsidies for wind and solar. These days, wind and solar in levelized cost of energy, which is dollars per megawatts created, megawatts hours created, I should say, because we're talking about energy, of course, then those renewable energies like solar and wind are cheaper than the incremental cost of running coal and oil-fired plants. So the only problem is that these are, of course, assets that have been invested in. That's why it's difficult to get rid of them. The question is, why would we invest still in coal-fired plants? That is a miracle to me.
But, you know, that's really interesting because, you know, China and China is building about one coal-fired plant a month. So they're all in on coal, which is the dirtiest, and you're saying it's not the cheapest.
No, it's not. Yeah, of course, you always have to look at the sort of the system that is operating them. Yeah, so for we look at real costs. You and I, the US, Europe, we're looking at real costs. So I would be surprised if any investor in our parts of the world would touch coal anymore. It just doesn't make any sense. In China, of course, they have political aspects of that as well. But if you look at the announcement, they seem to be very clear that they have to get rid of that trend as well, and that they're putting a brake on as we speak. But there is a lot of momentum going on. The biggest worry I have at the moment is actually India, because in China, they're going for coal plants that have the least CO2 per megawatt. In India, we still have very inefficient plants. That is a real problem. Yeah.
So we'll come back to the political aspects of this. We're not, you know, we're not politicians, but no. But there are some political issues that you have to deal with. So, you know, we've talked about the various sources and the percent, but what are the environmental impacts of each form? In other words, which ones are the best for the environment and which ones are the worst? Just kind of go through them in order if you can.
Yeah, I'll try. Now, two aspects here, really, Steve. One is the carbon footprint. That's what everybody is talking about now. But we have to look at other aspects of this as well. Yeah, it isn't just the carbon footprint. But let's stay with the carbon footprint. Coal is 80 times more carbon per megawatt hour.
80 times.
Yeah, on average.
Oh.
Yeah. Than gas and wind. Wind and nuclear. Gas. And I'm only talking about the combined cycle gas stations. The other normal gas ones are not being built anymore. That is half of that of coal, and solar is about 5% of coal.
So coal is 80 times more than nuclear.
Yeah.
Gas is about half of that, and then solar is just a small fraction. Why is there any impact from solar?
when you look at these things, you have to look at the life cycle analysis of everything. Yeah, so you have to look at how you produce them, what is the mining involved, and all that. So this is a long chain of things you have to look at.
So you're including the impact of the manufacture of the solar panels and that sort of thing, which is why there's anything. But then there's the other environmental. We talk about, everybody's focused on carbon dioxide because it creates global warming, and it's a, you know, that was the subject of our last discussion. But all of these forms of energy cause other forms of environmental impact. Talk about that.
Now again, I'm sorry that I might be a anti-coal lobbyist here, but the worst is of course the dust and the gases that come out of coal-fired plants. Now we have some filtering going on and all of that, but not everywhere in the world. So that's air pollution is a really serious issue, and then of course you have the mining, and that causes environmental damage as well. So all in all, that is something that we should really not pursue anymore. And I think that is part of the reason, Steve, why in China, for example, and increasingly in India, people are stepping back from coal, because that air pollution is causing such enormous problems in the environment that the population doesn't accept it anymore. So I think we will see the demise of that.
Right. There's CO2, which is one form of air pollution, but you're talking about, you know, smog, particulates, and the impact on people's lungs and that sort of thing.
Yes, exactly.
There's also water implications here.
Yeah, depending on the filter system, you have sulfur dioxide and stuff like that coming out, which then can cause damage in the immediate surroundings. Yeah. We have to say oil isn't, it is a lot better because the dust issue doesn't exist to that large extent. There are some aerosols that coming out, of course, which aren't nice either. But we know about oil spills, so the transport backwards and forwards of oil is a hazardous thing to do. And if we burn heavy oils, then we get also dust and air pollution. Yeah. So, you know, cruise ships, for example, they tend to use very heavy oil, the dark part of the refinery. So that's not a good thing. But, you know, people sometimes say nuclear is a non-polluting one. It pollutes something very significant because it's a waste that lasts for very long, actually millions of years, and that's the nuclear waste. And it's, of course, causing that problem of potential proliferation of nuclear waste that can be used to create dirty bombs. So also there. But hydropower that everybody loves and says, oh, that's wonderful, and doesn't do anything, it has environmental and social damages. You know, we've seen the dams that have been built, for example, in Africa and also in China, that have caused environmental damage, biodiversity loss, and also dislocation of large populations. So it's not free of these effects as well. And, you know, solar and wind have negative impact on wildlife and can cause noise pollution. So we shouldn't pretend that it's completely black and white. But when you compare like with like, I would say the environmental impacts from solar and wind are by order of magnitude smaller than the other ones that we see.
Now, you didn't mention gas. So coal's the worst. Oil is better, but then gas is in there after that, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, gas. Of course, we have also the drilling for gas and all of that, and the flaring of gas that causes pollution. But in all, in terms of other environmental impact, it's not as bad as coal and oil. But of course, it is the third biggest one in terms of greenhouse gas.
Yeah. So the renewables, which are now solar and wind, are, you know, what everybody's trying to push. And, you know, we're up to what you said, 14%. The problem is the episodic nature of the production with renewables, because by definition, you don't control when the sun shines or when the wind blows, right? And so that's the concern. And so that leads to storage, right?
Yeah. Now, quite rightly so. I mean, one thing that at some point in time came a little bit as a surprise to me, when you look at, in my parts of the world, the wind is blowing when the sun isn't shining, and the sun is shining when the wind isn't blowing. So we actually get a more linear supply of wind and solar than you would expect. But still, you cannot rely on that these two are your supply, and you will be able to serve this grid with its fluctuating demands. So if we go this direction, we have to work on storage. And of course, a lot of people recognize that. And it's a huge business opportunity. And innovation is just amazing that is happening. And by the way, everybody thinks of lithium ion batteries. Yeah, and of course, that is the thing that is developing the most at the moment. But there are completely different technologies being developed as well. So I've just seen a company from Israel, they're using flywheels to store energy very efficiently. I mean, flywheels have been around for energy storage for a long time. But they rotate aluminium discs in high vacuum. And it's amazing the performance when you see it. So innovation is happening in this field.
So in a high vacuum, you cut the friction, and so these discs essentially continue to move. And so the storage part of it is just sort of a continuous motion machine that then can be used to generate energy.
Exactly. And the benefit of that compared to a battery is you can do this 10 times a day if you have to. So it's horses for courses, of course. That one will not be the major one, but sometimes you want that capability, and it's comparable in cost. Yeah.
We're talking to Dr. Uwe Schalte about energy production, the impact on the environment, and so forth. Next, we'll look into the future and explore the role of business and government in advancing energy technologies. But first, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back.
Interested in this content? You can find this and much more at our Conference Board website, www.conference-board.org. Or, even better, contact our membership team and your company can enjoy the benefits of our in-depth research around the economy, environmental, social, and governance issues, public policy, marketing and communications, and human capital. As a member of the Conference Board, you will be able to have full access to all of our cutting-edge research, leading indicators, benchmarking, and data services, in addition to webcasts and podcasts such as the one you are enjoying now.
Welcome back to CEO Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board, and today I'm joined by the leader of our global Sustainability Center at the Conference Board, Dr. Uwe Schulte. Okay, Uwe, so we've talked about what the production is today, what the environmental impact is, you know, what the costs are. So where does that take us in terms of the grid of the future, the electric grid of the future? And, you know, what's nirvana and what's the gap between nirvana and where we are today?
No, Steve, I have to say I'm not an expert in this. So there are people better positioned. But let me just give you an overview how I see it with my limited visibility of things. The first thing is that we will have a much more distributed way of generating electricity. And for that, we will require what some people call an intelligent grid. So what this means is, and I just got a meter installed that is two-way. Yeah, so it meters and it communicates. It can receive information to say, in principle, it doesn't do this at the moment, but in principle, run your washing machine now. Yeah, rather than in 3 hours. So if I have the variability that I plug it in and the thing will only start it when it thinks it's appropriate. Or, for example, it can say, you have an electric car, it's linked to the grid. I'm going to use your battery at the moment for storage rather than anything else. And I might actually draw something out of it again when I need it. So we will see that. And to share another one of these things, I have converted in Germany, we are not so concerned with cooling down our houses yet. It's coming more and more. It's still heating in the winter. And I have now a fuel cell powered heating system, which is basically doing both things. It generates electricity and it heats my house and my water, of course. So these things will develop and we will develop that sort of grid. I think that's one thing. The other thing is that we have learned over the years now to distribute energy, electricity, I should say, across very long distances with relatively little losses. That's actually using, instead of alternating current, direct current. That has been around for a long time, but this has been improved a lot. So we will see both better distribution and more decentralized, I would say.
Yeah, so basically the smart grid of the future will load level. It will help usage or demand more effectively meet the supply, and when you know that is most available and cheapest, presumably in the off hours, you know, the off commercial hours and so forth. So it'll be very interesting. You get into a lot of issues with the naysayers. Will bring this up, about government tracking and the intrusion and all of that, and we've got to deal with that because those are real issues. But you know, the efficient use of the grid clearly is important. Now, one of the things, Uwe, you've said is that the grid is in much better shape in Europe than it is in the U.S. and certainly in other developing countries. Talk about that.
You see, what has happened over a long period of time is that in Europe, we have put a lot of the distribution underground already. Yeah. And let's face it, with increased storms and heavy rain issues, that is more resilient than, you know, plugging another cable at another wooden pole somewhere. Sorry for being a bit dismissive here, but sometimes when I see infrastructure like that, you know, I lived a few years in Brazil. We had this everywhere there, but in Brazil, they have started to remove that sort of installation. And then I come to large cities in the US and I still see it there. That needs changing.
Yeah, so it needs to go underground to prevent it, you know, the tree limbs and wind and storms from taking it out. But the problem is then land use and laws and the cost. You know, it's cheaper to string it overhead. But and you see it in planned developments and, you know, newer areas, but still in the older areas, we've got a long way to go. So infrastructure needs, you know, fascinating. This topic is battery storage. You touched on it in earlier in our conversation, but part of the issue right now, I mean, if you could imagine a day where there was just a small solar panel, I don't know your favorite size, but, 2x2 panel that you can put on the top of a roof and put a battery in the house so that it would store the the energy and be able to use it whenever you needed it. Boy, that's a killer app. And then you don't even need the grid. You can take every house off grid. But the technology is not there yet. The aspirations are. So we've got to shrink solar and we've got to somehow make batteries more efficient. But talk about what you see in the pipeline on those two dimensions.
Let me just point out on that one, that self-sufficient house you just talked about, it requires one more thing, and that's in proper insulation. Because whether you do cooling or heating, you can't cope with badly insulated houses. So there is another huge business opportunity, by the way, and that will come our way. Now, on batteries, Steve, you might recall I'm a chemist by training. I always do a disclaimer and say it's so long ago, just to say I had to do an early presentation about liquid crystal displays. And when I presented at the time, and that shows you how long ago it is, I said there might be a possibility to use that for TV screens. I was laughed out of the room at the time. So long ago.
People have been laughing at you for a long, long time.
No, I'm just wanting to say that, you know, my chemistry is a bit way back. But I have to say, I think I looked at batteries half a year ago. And what the technology was and everything. And I didn't see one thing coming. In 2023, we will have a sodium-based battery, which is comparable to the lithium-ion battery. It is better at low temperature. It's faster loading, but it has a disadvantage. It uses more space and it has less energy density. But still, it is, but that is very early days. So they will overcome that as well. So think about this. Half a year ago, I didn't see it, but probably other people did, of course. But now, in 2 years' time, it will be in cars. So we see a huge push in development in battery technology. And the next round of battery technology, as far as I see it, is got to be solid state. You know, the lithium-ion batteries, you've seen some cars burning. The reason is that the electrolyte that makes the ions float and creating the charge or distributing the charge and the electricity, those electrolytes are actually flammable. And if certain cells start to overheat, then this is a problem. We can get rid of the electrolyte completely because there is now, you know, 3D printing, which you do layer by layer very carefully. They can now make very thin layers of electrolyte, solid electrolyte, and therefore get rid of the liquid. Once we've achieved that, the batteries will be smaller. They will charge faster as well. So that's the next big step. And the good news is we have developments in the US and the UK and Sweden that are extremely promising on that one in terms of technology.
Yeah, the one thing that's interesting about chemistry is that the periodic table doesn't change. And, you know, all of these new sources that you've talked about have elements that are really, for all of it, remember, everybody's got to go back to your high school chemistry. It's the elements that are really high up, meaning more plentiful and cheaper as a result. Yes. And, you know, the problem right now, one of the problems with the batteries is there's so much rare earth minerals required, and they're in small quantities, and they're they're hard to get at, and it's more mining. What you're talking about, though, are more plentiful and safer elements, literally elements that we could use.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people speculate in cobalt at the moment because for the lithium ion battery at the moment, the anode needs a cobalt. I wouldn't bet completely on cobalt because if, for example, the sodium one comes along, that doesn't need cobalt.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think there is a lot of innovation out there. My recommendation to everyone is watch that space. Don't take anything for granted at the moment. We will have some really big scale effects coming soon.
Yeah. And so, you know, if I was running a government, it seems to me, which I'm not and I'm never going to be for a lot of reasons, Uwe, but it seems to me that I would be doing basic investment in, you know, in these renewable production to make them more efficient, but also the storage area. So there is a role here for government and there is a role for business. Talk about what the role is today and, you know, what you think the political aspects of that are.
I think we can, government has to incentivize the renewable and create structures that enable private investors to do the job. The grid That needs attention from the government, because we have to make sure that nobody gets hold of the grid, because we have to generate equal opportunity to everyone. And by the way, hacking, especially in the smart grid, is an issue that we have to really watch out. What I would also say is one of the things that will come, and people have to be aware, is carbon tax in one way or another, because otherwise we can't do this. And for government, that means that tax shouldn't sit in their pockets. That should go back to those people most affected by carbon tax, so we don't get social issues like the yellow vests in France. That has to be avoided by all means. Another thing I think important is hydrogen, green hydrogen. We didn't touch on that today, but there are issues with hydrogen because you have to first create energy, the electricity, and then hydrogen. So it's not as efficient as going directly. But for example, big lorries, for ships, and potentially even planes, that are solutions. And for the industry like cement, and especially for steel, this will be very important.
Yeah, so you see the role of government and business, and probably partnership, right?
Yes.
Public-private partnerships in this, for investment in infrastructure, also investment in basic R&D, and then, of course, the adoption of these areas. You know, we're not getting into the whole Paris Climate Accords and all of that political stuff there, but you know there are issues with that, and yeah. You know, how do you get there, and how should, you know, there are some people who believe that the developed world should subsidize the developing nations, and you know there are a lot of social issues with all of that which we're not getting into today, but anyway, lots of opportunity here. Uwe, thank you so much as always for joining us and providing our listeners with a roundup of insights on all things energy.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening in to CEO Perspectives. Every few weeks, I'll be joined by a leader from one of our centers, as well as other business executives, to provide insights on the issues of our time. We'll cover leading topics in public policy, environmental, social, and governance. We'll talk about marketing, communications, the economy, human capital, whatever you can think of. Please share CEO Perspectives with your colleagues, and I know that they'll enjoy it as well. I'm Steve Odland, and this podcast has been brought to you by the Conference Board.
You have been listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.